Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
If you haven't had a chance to hear the first part of our conversation with Maurice Clarett, you're going to want to do that now. In the first part of our conversation, we heard about the recruiting process for Maurice to Ohio State. We heard about NCAA violations. And we heard about the way a school just tossed somebody to the side when he became a perceived liability or too much trouble for that program. It's a story that's not unfamiliar to us, but it's a story that you need to hear.
We pick up the story of Maurice after he's kicked out of Ohio State and moves to California. He lives in Los Angeles for a year, awaiting to enter the NFL draft, where he's drafted by the Denver Broncos in 2005. He's cut and then ends up in jail. But jail doesn't have the last word for Maurice Clarett. His story is amazing. He's a model of a person that I think we all can admire. And so now you leave Ohio State, and what's your next step?
So at this point, I leave Ohio State, then I go to California. I'm in California for a couple years, and for the most part, what you could say, I would categorize it as just loss, right? And so, you know, you take something you've worked your entire life for, something that you thought that was going to bring so much promise, and, you know, this is no knock to anybody else, but I knew I had a legitimate chance of going to the NFL. You know what I'm saying? Like a very legitimate chance of going and making something of myself. And, you know, this is what I thought was a real thing. And, you know, at that point, I was kicked out. I went to California, just kind of lost for a couple of years. Fell into like a deep state of depression, a state of depression I didn't even know existed until, you know, I went through that. You know, I just went through that whole deal. And from there, after going through that for a couple of years, the NFL called me back and they said, "Hey, we would like to invite you to the NFL Combine." So I went to the Combine in 2005, believing that like, I could just muster up, you know, the ability and the courage to, you know, have a great performance. But what actually happened was I wasn't prepared on any level. So what actually happened was that I went out to the Combine and I busted the whole combine, just to be blunt and frank about it. And, you know, I didn't perform very well, so I didn't think that I was going to get drafted, you know, at all. And, you know, I ended up getting drafted in the third round with the 101st pick, and I ended up going to Denver and becoming a Denver Bronco. And, you know, I always apologize to even to the Denver Broncos, because what Denver thought they were getting and what they actually got was two different things. You know, by the time that Denver had drafted me, you know, I had been used to partying, drinking, and drugging, and just having a good time for a couple months or for a couple years. And when they got me there, they was assuming that they got the same 18-year-old kid who was committed to playing football and doing things that he was told and all that other stuff. But, you know, I didn't brought all my baggage to Denver. And to their credit, you know, they didn't just leave me hanging. They tried to basically get me some assistance. So they tried to pair me up with a sports psychologist. They also tried to, you know, get me some mentorship around me. But at that time, I was just so distant from people, and I didn't want anybody's help. I thought that I could get it together myself. And I was just pushing away every resource that they possibly could lend to me. And eventually, after a while, after numerous attempts on their behalf, we had to basically cut me and go their separate way.
So, can you go deeper into that time that you spent out in L.A., and what was life like? Where were you living? Were you working out at all?
Did you have any people supporting you?
Yeah, you went from Columbus, where you had structure under Coach Tressel, to California, where you have less structure. And I know you tried to get in the NFL even a year earlier, but could you talk to us a little bit about your time out in L.A. and kind of how you did go down some of those alternate paths?
Yeah, so when I was out in L.A., I was with a gentleman who was a good friend of mine. He's still to this day. His name was High Walk Knight, and he was somebody I had met out there during my time in L.A. We became friends. I told him about my situation, about me playing college football and things not working out, and he never really knew who I was, which was odd, never really knew who I was, didn't really care for the most part, and he was like, hey, regardless of what's going on, you have a friend in L.A. since you've come out here, and so on and so forth. And so he was helping me to foot the bill for my training sessions, but the training sessions were like secondary to the lifestyle. And to anybody who's been to Los Angeles, California as a 20-something-year-old, it was just a lot. When you spend a lot of time on Sunset, when you spend a lot of time at the beach, when you're starting to live like you're successful and you're really not successful, I believe that that's a problem. And that was one of the biggest things that was an issue for me. And so, my friend and my buddy, he was extremely rich and he was wealthy and had, multiple homes within L.A. County and had a ton of success within the real estate game. And I had been living basically as his sidekick. I began to believe that those things were mine. I just basically lost perspective. And through losing perspective, I just got caught up into the lifestyle of that. I would go and work out and run and sprint. But after that, there was no nutrition. There was no structure. I'm coming in at 5 and 6 in the morning, and for the most part, everything that would constitute you as being a professional, I would admittedly say, I did the opposite. Or for all good that was done, I stacked a bunch of bad on top of it. When I say bad, I mean just reckless behavior with partying, hanging out with women, and just basically not being a professional. And I think that after so much time, just caught up with, it's only so long that I know for a fact, it's only so long that you can, choose to destroy your body with substances and alcohol and drinking and stuff like that before it all catches up to you as a professional athlete.
Yeah. So during all that time, which, by the way, just sounds really lonely and sad. I know that must have been such a painful time for you. During all that time, did you still have contact with any of your coaches or teammates or people from the sports world?
No, and that was it. I think that was a big thing. When I was done, a lot of coaches would tell guys, Reese kind of isn't with us anymore. And, now you're dealing with, you're sort of like an outcast. I had to deal with the reality of that, of being an outcast towards, of what was going on. And I was, that was rough, because you put so much time in, you make friendships with people, you become who you are. And the next thing just because you're suspended from the sport, nobody really wants to deal with you in any regard. And that was depressing within itself because, you got to imagine at the end of the day, I may be this guy that's, running people over and breaking tackles and, all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, I'm still a human being. Yeah. And to not have basic friendship and brotherhood with guys, that can, as young as you are and as cool as you think you are, that can feel lonely.
Yeah.
I can remember this, and I give you this one. being out and about in public and being at parties or different social functions, they're like, you know, we can hide from ourselves for so long and we can act like things don't bother us and we can, you know, we can pretend, you know, a lot. But there's times where you'll be around people and the circumstances or the environment should mimic that you're having a good time. But I can remember, just like you said, feeling lonely, feeling isolated. And now understanding what mental health issues are or how they start or how addiction starts and stuff like that from dealing within the industry now, I understood how all of that stuff came to be. And I have a full understanding of how I got to where I was at. And it all started from isolation, you know, and oftentimes through isolation, you drink, you drug, you do other things to substitute what you're actually feeling. And you use the drugs to process the emotions instead of like your real thoughts. And you need to heal from that stuff, you know what I mean? So anytime you're that attached, like, you know, you're that attached to a sport, right, where you put so many hours. And I'm not talking about, like, I just wasn't, like, an average player. I was, like, very good, in my opinion, right? And I said it humbly, right?
In many people's opinion.
Yeah, not just yours. In fact, Jim Bowman said to me, you were the best football player he'd ever been around, and compared you to Walter Payton.
Yes, I tell you this, you put a lot of time and hours into stuff, and there's no difference in a relationship. And you want things to work out for the better, or you want to have success, you know, with your endeavor. And when you lose it, you know, you just can't walk away like, hey, 18, I won a championship. Okay, I can't play this year. Like, okay, nothing bothers me. It doesn't work like that.
And that was also, like, your community. I mean, you had left your community and made them your new community at Ohio State. And I mean, you had put a lot of eggs in that basket. So, you know, again, I don't think people totally take in how much these young players are carrying in their hearts, in their spirits, their aspirations, how much they want things to work out and how much they don't take for granted, you know, the magnitude of all this. I just listen to your story and think, that is so much for a young man your age to carry around by yourself after, you know, all the thing. And a plus with just, like you said, your extraordinary ability. Like, you'd think, well, it should just be easy street for you. Well, it's not.
I think one thing that I think you can kind of hit on that. I think people don't view players as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're viewed as entertainers, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that since they're viewed as entertainers or, you know, a replaceable item, that, you know, the human element is devalued. And, you know, hey, throw him away. Let's get somebody else here to entertain us and go from there. Almost you should be happy that, you know, we're giving you this opportunity.
Right.
That right there is often taken out of context. You know, is very, you know, you do have the ability to be grateful for the opportunity, but then you also do have the ability to be a human being as well, and to want to be treated like one throughout the process.
That's right.
And I think more even what you all are saying is that, you know, and just as you have those two folds, there's another fold to say, hey, you know, what I'm doing, it's constituted as that I'm a student athlete, but I'm actually a business and I would like to be compensated, you know, as such based upon the reality of the situation.
If you had just received from the university a few thousand dollars just to take care of your car, just to keep your cell phone up, so much of this could have been avoided.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people,
100%.
Whenever they hear the words pay players, they think, well, players want a mansion. No 20-year-old wants a mansion or anything like that.
Well, they might want one, but that's not their first priority.
Right. Their first priority is gas money home, a reliable car, maybe even not for you who's going to the combine, but some players buy a suit for interviews after school. You know, in 2005 then, when the Denver Broncos draft you in the third round and you don't make the team, and you painted that picture. You don't make the team after, you know, about a year or two of living a life that isn't training your body to be a suit of armor for the NFL. And so you're not ready physically, you're not ready spiritually, you're not ready mentally. Can you talk us through what happens after the Denver Broncos cut you and where your life goes?
That's probably one of the darker of moments of my life. So I thought like getting cut from Ohio State was like a bad thing. But getting cut from Denver was probably a little bit worse than that. And I got to say it was worse because, you know, it was a replay in the first breakup, you know, times 10, you know, and to see your face blasted on TV, to see, you know, everybody saying, hey, I told you so. And to walk around and to be identified as a double failure, but one in high school or one in college and then the other one in the NFL, I was very rough, you know. And so I remember coming back to Ohio, and I was like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. I remember connecting with Coach Trussell, and I was like, man, I'm lost. Like, I knew I was lost, right? And, you know, I knew I was feeling something different when I went to a party. And, you know, anybody who's ever experienced it, there's plenty of people who have experienced it before because, you know, I've had this talk about depression and identifying when you're depressed and detached from your personal body. And I remember I was smoking marijuana at a party. And anytime you smoke, you know, you're obviously supposed to feel high. But I remember smoking and I didn't feel nothing. And I told myself, I was like, you know, I remember saying to myself, like, you know, what the heck? You know, I said something a little bit stronger. But for podcast purposes, we'll clean it up, right? But I remember saying to myself, like, man, I'm really messed up right now. You know for a fact that you're not mentally healthy. And it's scary because you can identify you're not mentally healthy, but you don't have a roadmap to get healthy. And I think that that's one of the rare experiences that I've experienced in my lifetime that I'm not sure you can duplicate that unless you actually go through it. Where you're depressed and you have to process that, right? And so I remember, like, man, you know, I'm lost, I'm confused. I talked to Coach Trussell. He had told me to go back to school and to work out. But I was like, you know, Coach Truss, I can't go back to school. This is what I'm thinking to myself when he told me. I'm like, I can't go back to school because I can't do the work, you know. I just, you know, academically, I haven't pushed through school probably since the ninth grade. So there was nothing in school that I could do. And so what actually happened was, like, me going through this process of projecting my feelings on everybody. So I hated myself, but I was always still aggressive. So I said, man, I'm about to get into the streets and make money in the streets, but I'm going to be a beast in the streets instead of being a beast on the football field. I ended up catching a robbery case in downtown Columbus on December 31st, New Year's Eve, 2005, transitioning to 2006. And so, you know, that had happened amongst the things that happened with Ohio State and the NFL. And then, you know, 3 weeks after I got the robbery charge, found out that my lady was pregnant, and now she's pregnant. She's panicking because she's looking at me like, man, you know, I'm about to have a kid with a guy who's about to go to jail, and he has nothing going on. And that was, you know, that was another level of stress. And then eventually, August of 2006, I got picked up on a high-speed chase running from the police, and I had weapons in my car. And eventually, I ended up going to prison. And probably that was probably one of the most relieving days of my life to get incarcerated because it was the first time that I had basically somebody else have control of me to basically keep me out of my own way because, you know, just the thinking that I had been doing prior to that was just leading me in so many different bad directions. And I know it's embarrassing as an adult to say that, you know, you had to have somebody else have some level of control over your life. But, hey, it was what it was. It helped out. You know, I went to prison, and it helped me tremendously. And that's, you know, kind of like how things unfolded.
Wow. I mean, that's such an amazing story. I mean, really, I wonder if when you look back on, like you said, this really shadowy time when you just, things were kind of spiraling out of control. You knew you needed help. You knew something needed to change. So much so that prison was the structure. You know, prison was the thing that kind of jolted you back into some kind of, you know, control of your life. As you look back on that, what are some of the things that you can name that kept you going? Like, what are some of the kind of inner resources that allowed you to even just see prison that way?
I think the unpacking or unfolding of myself came from therapy. Mm. You know, a lot of people have a big misconception about prison. They think that it's about big guys and muscles and fights and, you know, knives and drugs and rape and all that the crazy stuff that you see on TV. But, you know, prison also has an element where you have individuals who are trying to get better. And there's a bunch of therapeutic courses, you know, counseling in prison that goes on and that takes place. And, you know, probably for about 19 months, you know, I was going through the same courses or different courses, but all psychosocial and emotional supportive courses. And, you know, being in group therapy and inside of prison and while I was in therapy and sort of like healing with other men who had basically committed crimes and had different drug and alcohol issues. I was then able to start to read a bunch, for 4 years. I was basically locked in a housing unit for 20 hours out the day. And so, from being inside so much, from 06 to 2010, from October to about March, in prison, you don't go outside. You know, you're required to be inside. There's just a tremendous amount of reading that you do and personal development that I had done that a lot of guys do. During that time, and you start to get in touch with your mind, body, and spirit. I found out that's the trifecta to governing yourself and to bring some sort of balance into this self-awareness process that I think every human being at some point in life goes on when they're separating what they do from who they are. And I think that's the rebirth of everybody. That's just my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. And, I went through that whole process in prison, to become detached from sports and, a title of what I do and to figure out what it is that I love, who am I, what do I like, and these are questions that, a lot of guys still, they're 30, 40, 50 years old, these people have no clue because they're so attached to, a role or a status from something. And, I was fortunate enough to have that happen to me and to go through that process and, learn to love myself. And I don't know if that answers your question,
yeah,
but it's kind of what came to mind when you asked that.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I think John would probably really resonate with that. That kind of journey to kind of figure out what you love and how football takes up so much space when you are in football. That's supposed to be what you eat, drink, and breathe and everything. And kind of shaking loose of that a little bit is important and kind of figuring out, like, actually, who am I without the role or the status or the the kind of social capital that I have when I play football or I coach football.
Yeah, but football becomes tainted when the business of football gets in it, right? When you when you bring the status and when you bring the finances and you bring the politics and the stuff, and it becomes less about the character that's being developed through the actual function of football. And when it becomes less about that, it would be the same thing that would happen to the military if you somehow monetized the military and it became less about discipline and hard work and, getting your butt kicked and getting back up and, moving forward and learning. It's kind of like the same situation. And that's what happens to football when football becomes diluted and we try to call something different than what it is. We can end this whole conversation with people being paid for football if you just actually pay people, for what they were worth. It's like every other thing in America. Mm-hmm. If you go to any place of employment anywhere in the United States of America, people give you a resume and they say, okay, what's your value to what's going on? You know what I'm saying? And people figure that out, and then they say, okay, well, this has, like, it's based upon revenue generated. This is the importance of it, and then there's value to that. You know what I'm saying?
And based on revenue generated in Ohio State football, you were certainly at the top of that list for a spell.
Yeah, so, but you know, that's the funny thing about it. We seem to get it right with every other thing in the United States. And this is the funnier thing, right? In collegiate sports, where you have higher ed and just all of the brains in one place, we seem to can't sit down and have one conversation. You know, now you can charge that up to the NFL. You can say, hey, you know, the NFL, these guys are you know, businessmen. They have 1,000 other things going on. But when you have, you know, tens of thousands of students and professors who are highly educated, I would like to believe that with all these attorneys that universities have, I'm pretty sure that if there was a focus to get this thing right, that we could get it right. And, you know, I always say that the only way you'll get this thing right is if you have just young guys and just say, hey, you know, we'll just stop playing. Mm-hmm. And once you stop the money, you know, then people will get sense, you know. And you can have a productive conversation without being like, you know, this big revolution that's happening. And you can have an intelligent conversation as to what we're worth, because I'm pretty sure there's a simple mathematical equation. And, you know, it's simply being compensated for the work that you're putting in. But we're still in 2019. You know, we can figure out how to make iPhones and iMacs and, you know, MacBook Pros and all this other stuff. You know, we can build electric cars and everything else, but we can't figure out the mathematical equation for compensating players.
Talk about Maurice. When you got out of jail after 3.5 or 4 years that you were in there, you got out. Talk about your life now and the work that you're doing now. Such an important part of the community.
Yeah, I got out in 2010, and I went through, you know, just a transition period. And, you know, that probably belongs in a different podcast and platform. But eventually I built what is now called the Red Zone. And the Red Zone is, you know, it's named for a number of reasons. I felt like, you know, that, you know, in the Red Zone in football, it's a super important time either for the offense or the defense to rather score or to stop someone from scoring. And, you know, I opened up a mental health and drug and alcohol facility and named it after that, because most people who come to us, their life is sort of like in the Red Zone, in the danger zone, if you could think of it that way, and there's something that needs to happen. So you can either stop something from happening or you can go ahead and score yourself. And I just kind of played on those words and used that terminology, obviously being related to football. And to make a long story short, we're a mental health and drug and alcohol agency. We started back in, you know, 2016. And, you know, I've been on mental health medication since 2006 now, since about, you know, August or September of 2006. And it's helped my mind and the ability to control and manage myself better a lot easier. And I thank God every day that I was basically introduced to the appropriate medication that kind of has got me on this path and kind of keeps me going in the right direction. And after going through so many therapeutic services and also benefiting from mental health services, I still go to Ohio State outpatient service and still work with a psychiatrist now. I just thought to myself that, man, I wish there was more kids who understood this stuff, and I wish that there was more adults who had access to services, because I can remember, even as an adult, when I needed help, you know, there was no facility. I said, hey, you know, let me go over here and get some mental health assistance. And I always talk about, you know, mental health and psychosocial and emotional support, just like I talk about athletics. And so, if you're an athlete, if you want to get ready for a season, you would use, you know, football in the spring, the summer conditioning, fall camp, and you would know you would have to physically get better through all these stages to play for a season, only to use your body for that season. But, you know, when we talk about mental wellness or when we talk about our minds, we tend to forget that we use our minds and our mentality and our perspective every day when we make decisions, but we don't have skill sets or useful tools outside of what you may get on Sunday at church to help us effectively build up our minds, our mentality, our perspective, or even when it's injured, what do I do? You know, most people run to church But there's some other things outside of church that basically needs to be addressed with your psychosocial emotional health, that only therapy or some psychiatric medication could help you and give to you. And so I started, like I said, I started the Red Zone, and that's what we do. We help to address underlying issues. A lot of people who work for us are either, you know, social workers, professional counselors, qualified mental health specialists, behavioral specialists, or chemical dependency counselors in some capacity. And these are the people who we engage in the community with. We engage with adolescents and adults. We're in Youngstown, Columbus, and some other various cities throughout the state of Ohio. You know, I enjoy what I do. I love what I do. Every day I get up, you know, there's a new challenge and something to do, a new troop of people to lead, and that's, you know, that's pretty much that.
Amen.
That's saving lives. It's not just changing lives, it's saving lives. And it's so beautiful to just hear that that's how you've channeled all this wisdom that you really have had since you were a young kid in a lot of ways. And I guess one of the things I'd like to close with is, if you could give one piece of advice to a young man who is thinking about that he wants to play college football, what would that piece of advice be?
It's pretty easy. One, you know, I'm not, let me make this clear. I'm not bashing football because I love football. I really do. But the part where I get the most out of my life of anything I've ever done, I would challenge more young men to engage in recreational reading. And I'm pretty sure that's not the answer that you're probably expecting. But I found out more about myself and more about where football fits in and more about who I am as a person from recreational reading than I've done anything. All stuff on personal development, self-awareness, entrepreneurship and business. And just it made the world more colorful. It's raised my level of consciousness. And it just made me a better person overall. And I think that oftentimes when you're into athletics, you think that everything from the world or everything that you do in the world has to have the physical component to it. And it's very like animalistic, it's very primitive and very egotistic and ego driven, right? But I think there's a humility that's developed through reading from the fact that you don't know a whole bunch because you start to realize that there's a lot of beautiful minds in this world. And you start to realize that the world is a much bigger place than just the gridiron. Mm-hmm. And when you're transitioning for the rest of your life and you're meeting people and you're just trying to discover who you are, recreational reading, be it through the physical component of books or through audiobooks, has done more for me in my life. And I've been able to communicate and articulate more of my experiences through developing myself through recreational reading that I would have ever imagined. But that would be my piece of advice to go find some books that you enjoy to read and to just discover yourself throughout the process, whether you play football for 4 years, 3 years, or, you know, whether you not play at all.
I'll tell you what, Maurice, that might be the best piece of advice I've ever heard.
I'm sure that our listeners will agree that knowing more about Maurice Clarett makes us all better people. I think for me, Maurice's story raises up just the both and reality of the fact that this remarkable human being is thriving today both because of and in spite of football. And the more we can listen to him, and the more that we can truly take in what his life tells us about many lives and systems and habits of mind, the more football and collegiate life can actually begin to have a partnership that actually does make people's lives better because of it. not in spite of it.
At the end there, after he recommended recreational reading as his advice to any young athlete in high school getting ready to go to college, I thought to myself, I can't wait to race out to our next team meeting, get in my high school class, and just scream at the top of my lungs that Maurice Clarett has advised all of you, one of the toughest dudes to ever play the game, one of the best to ever play the game. The best thing you can do is be a recreational reader. I'd say that's something our listeners can hang their hat on.
Amen to that. You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.